You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
I'd like to welcome everybody this evening. My name is Anthony Richter. I'm the Associate Director of the Open Society Institute. I also direct something called the Central Eurasia Project, and this forum takes place in the context of our ongoing work in the South Caucasus and Central Asia. I was actually in Tbilisi just a few days ago and got to meet with Tamuna and quite a number of her colleagues there, and I was looking into the question of this evening's event, so I feel fresh and looking forward to this. The subject of the discussion, as you all know, is Georgia 1 year later, where has the aid money gone? It's a rather provocative sounding question, and it will be up to, in part, Tamuna and Samia Mitra to justify this title or to put it into to further context. As you know, October 22nd, I believe, 1 year ago, there was a donor conference held to collect pledges and commitments to reconstruct Georgia and help it out of the aftermath of the short Russia-Georgia war. Of course, there's been a kind of a final report, as it were, on the Russia-Georgia war that was published about 3 weeks ago, and both the Russian Federation and Republic of Georgia were quick to point to that report, each from their own perspective, indicating that it vindicated their particular version of events. This evening, we will be trying to draw some conclusions about the assistance that came as an aftermath of the conflict. And for that, we have two highly informed speakers who played roles both in the preparation of the donor conference and then monitoring the aid flows that came afterwards. The end, we have Samia Mitra, who is a freelance economic development consultant working for the World Bank. He led the multi-donor coordinated Georgia Joint Needs Assessment, the so-called JNA, and the JNA was the basic process and document on the basis of which all of the aid that has subsequently been pledged by the UN, the Asian Development Bank, EBRD, European Union, and other donors has been predicated. And then to my right, we have Tamuna Karasunidze. Tamuna is Executive Director of Transparency International Georgia. And Tamuna is part of a coalition of Georgian civil society organizations, including GILA, Green Alternatives, and others, which have taken it upon themselves to attend to the public interest involved with the grants, the foreign grants, and the loans tendered to Georgia. And she's going to be speaking about the work of the coalition and their findings. I think that probably the order that would be most logical would be to start with Samia Mitra, talk about the JNA, and then hear from Tamuna about the findings and work of the coalition. Each of our speakers is going to talk about 15 minutes, and then we'll move to a discussion with you all. I want to just let you know that this event is being recorded. It's already being recorded, and it will be then put up on our website for posterity. So that means that far more than the people, far more numbers of people than those present in the room this evening will be able to listen to it. I was just in the South Caucasus in Azerbaijan, and as some of you know, we had an event here on Azerbaijan a few weeks ago, and I kept on being stopped and complimented about the event by various people who had no way of being there. So your words will go quite far. So Samya Mitra, please, the floor is yours.
All right, well, thank you very much, and thank you for inviting us here to the OSI, and I'm very pleased to be here. You say our words will go far. Well, physically, I suppose they will go far, but the fact they are being recorded, you can check a year from now and 5 years from now whether they were far-sighted enough or not. Anyway, I've been getting a stream of emails from Jeff Yarbrough of the OSI saying, could I speak about this topic? No, on second thoughts, maybe it would be better to do this, and so on. So I made a list of six things he really wanted me to talk about in 15 minutes, and I would like to keep to that time limit, because I think the best is the best part of an event like this is really the discussion. These six topics on first, the JNA process, its main conclusions and how it was developed. Second, a year later, what have been our principal findings about where the aid came from and where it's going and where it has gone. Third, he wanted me to say something on the IDP resettlement programs, looking at it now a year from when the IDPs were created, that is the conflict itself. Fourth, something on aid coordination and impact monitoring. Fifth, he said something on aid conditionality. And sixth, on the transparency of the JNA process. Is that the sense of the kinds of topics you'd like to hear about, or would you like to drop one or two of these, or you tell me? And
that'll be fine.
That's fine. Okay. Well, on the JNA itself, I don't know what to assume about your state of knowledge, but as was mentioned in the introduction, a year ago we had this donor conference, which took place within 2 months of the end of the conflict, so it was really on a super fast timetable. Normally, donor conferences are organized 6 to 12 months after the end of a conflict, but there were very strong political and strategic reasons why Georgia should have been provided with assistance very rapidly, and therefore it was done very rapidly indeed. The main conclusions of the JNA were that Georgia was slightly unusual in the fortunate sense that physical infrastructure damage from the conflict, although tangible in places, was not really very serious. But there had been a very serious damage to the economy itself, to the reform efforts that the government had mounted and which were showing good results. And, of course, there was a very large human element to the tragedy, the social cost of the conflict itself. So prior to the conflict, the economy was growing at a very fast clip, 10-12% a year annually for a number of years, and rising public expenditures were being financed through substantial increases in tax revenues, and foreign direct investment was coming in very large amounts indeed. Now, the conflict dealt a shock to the key pillars of this economic growth process. There was a weakening of investor confidence, so that a year from now we can see that foreign direct investment has largely disappeared, really. It's about running at about 10-15% to what it was before the conflict itself. There was a banking sector crisis. There was a consumer confidence contraction of liquidity in the banking sector itself, all of which caused a fall in growth to occur. And, of course, a few months later, we had the international financial crisis, which exacerbated all these effects. The social impact of the crisis arose chiefly from the very high number of the initially internally displaced persons, mostly, of course, from South Ossetia, a considerable number from the adjacent areas around South Ossetia, which is the Gori area, and a few, very few indeed, this time from Abkhazia, though slightly higher numbers from adjacent areas in Abkhazia itself. The government itself launched a very rapid and effective post-conflict recovery program, which consisted both of new investment activities as well as macroeconomic expansion, and this has begun to show good results. The JNA itself identified the need for donor support in three main areas. First, support for the rapid restoration of confidence. It was concluded that Georgia would be able to help itself best to restore economic growth if the donors came in as well and provided resources for poverty reduction and for investment. And therefore, a main theme of the JNA was an appeal to donors to provide support to the budget for counter-cyclical budgetary policies and therefore provide these external resources. It was also important to provide equity, debt, or guarantee support to the banking system, which actually faced a serious danger of collapse. And had that occurred, a year later, you can see what happens when banking systems collapse in far more advanced economies. The second prong of the JNA appeal was support for social needs. This had put the creation of the IDPs, and of course, when IDPs are created, they put a considerable amount of pressure on their host populations as well. These developments had put an unsustainable burden on fiscal resources, and it was particularly important to provide support for housing, social protection, and other programs that the JNA went into in considerable detail. And the final element of the JNA asked for support for certain critical investments, which were high-yield investments essential to maximizing the prospects for recovery, and these were largely in the infrastructure sector, in roads, in secondary roads, and in energy. So the total amount that the JNA appeal consisted of was for about $3.25 billion over a three-year period, roughly divided between budget support, the social needs I have talked about, as well as the infrastructure support itself. Now, the process by which the JNA was formulated was that it closely followed the agreements that the World Bank had reached with the United Nations system and with the European Union over a number of years. As you can imagine, this was not the first JNA to be put together. And experience had shown that donors had often acted in highly uncoordinated manner in the past. And therefore, this time, it was decided that the recently agreed methodology, which called for very close donor action and a sequencing of actions by different donors, would be put into effect. And Georgia was actually the first case of this method being tried out. At the invitation of the government, the World Bank took the lead, with the UN being a close partner. And there were a number of other international institutions, such as the Asian Development Bank, the European EBRD, the European Investment Bank, which also joined the team. Sector teams were formed in each of these critical areas that I've been talking about: health, education, social protection, the special needs of the IDPs, employment and livelihoods, as well as the different infrastructure sectors, macroeconomics, and banking. And an extensive use was made of a particular instrument called the Transition Results Framework, which was again developed as a part of this methodology, that brought together the objectives of the exercise, the outcomes that were expected, the monitoring variables that would be followed throughout this process, and the results that could be expected. And all of this was tied very closely to a flow of funds analysis of when the donors needed to come in what amounts, and in what sectors. So this provided a structure for the entire exercise could be placed. In this exercise, there was, of course, very close involvement with the government. The Georgian government at that time, and indeed today, continues to be highly capable in a technocratic sense, consisting of good leadership in the economic areas and the main reform areas. So this provided the basis for a very close and effective dialogue with the principal donors. At the same time, the exercise conducted a number of outreach efforts to involve civic society. There were meetings with the opposition leaders and opposition parties, for us to understand the political background and to see that their concerns about, in particular, the safeguards under which donor funds would be used would be built into the process, and that there would be proper accountability to Parliament, and that there would be proper accounting to society as a whole. In addition to this, the sector teams extensively used the work of and the experience of NGOs who had been in the field in Georgia, in some cases for a good number of years, who had developed a great deal of specialist knowledge and experience in their own sectors and in the implementation of their own programs. And an effort was made to integrate them into the teams. And I think we find that, for example, in the entire exercise to deal with the IDP effects and the housing for IDPs, the construction of durable households and so on, NGOs have been playing a greater and a greater role in a more of an integrated fashion in the implementation of these programs. So that gives me the cue to move to the point about the IDPs themselves. And I will not at the moment go into a lot of figures. I'll assume you have you have some of the background about the numbers involved, but very very briefly, we think today that about 30,000 IDPs still remain in Georgia itself in a displaced condition, which means that about 100,000 have been integrated in the sense that they have been able to return to the adjacent areas around South Ossetia. The IDPs who remain are largely those who come from South Ossetia itself, where, of course, return has not been possible. The overwhelming priorities under this program were to provide temporary shelters pending the construction of durable housing, providing IDPs with information on choices that take account of their and providing them with information about the clear selection criteria and the assistance that was to be provided to them, and, of course, ensuring IDP protection and human rights. Now, in many of these activities, which are very complex and which involve the coordinated actions of a number of different government bodies and ministries and agencies, as well as, of course, donors, and this is a field that you that we all understand is not something that governments do routinely. I mean, they don't have IDPs, so this is a whole new territory. It's often extremely difficult to get this right. And I do think it is quite impressive that the Georgian government managed to create new settlements for IDPs and construction units very, very rapidly in a framework of basically 6 months after the conflict ended. The IDP relocation process in a well-organized manner was largely successfully achieved. But there are some lessons, I think, for the future that may be of interest, and which is closely tied to the need to communicate clearly with IDPs and get their preferences well mapped and well integrated with the implementation process from an early on. And these are largely that greater transparency in decision making, a proper assessment of the social impact of resettlement and integration, proper profiling of beneficiaries is very important. And often when these processes are carried out in a very rapid manner, there may not be enough time to pay attention to these. Coming on more to issues of the aid coordination itself, the JNA, following the methodology that I've described to you, paid a great deal of attention to coordination and monitoring. There was an effort made to build in systems for monitoring results, tracking aid, and assessing impact. And it is now really it is the responsibility of the government, as the program is being implemented over a period of 3 to 4 years, to take account of international experience, to build these systems, and to use it properly. Because monitoring systems can often be used to identify changes in needs as they arise, as indeed in a dynamic situation you will have a needs assessment is not static. New needs arise, old needs disappear for whatever reason, and it is very important for the government to be flexible in tracking such developments. I've mentioned the transitional results framework, which are now being used, I think, in a fairly disciplined way, but in some areas they are being used more effectively than others, and I think this is one area where the NGO community and other implementers can play a bigger role in assisting the government in Georgia, which remains a fairly lean government, in monitoring results using these frameworks. The tracking of aid is being carried out effectively by the Ministry of Finance in Georgia. Some of you may be familiar with the information that they have been posting on their websites pretty regularly. This process started a few months after the conflict ended, approximately 6 months or so into the donor-assisted three-month recovery program. And from that information, one can see quite clearly where funds are being allocated and where funding gaps have been arising. And it now remains for this aid tracking system to be closely linked to the monitoring, results monitoring that I was talking about earlier, preferably under the office of the Prime Minister or the Minister of Finance, so that both these instruments can be used most effectively. It also remains important to assess impact, which is something that is often forgotten. In addition to project-related impact assessments, which are fairly standard instruments, I think in Georgia it would be important to carry out periodic monitoring at the household levels, particularly for IDPs, using different survey methods. Citizen scorecards and so on have been mentioned, in order to keep project implementers well informed about the effectiveness of their interventions and room for improvements as they arise. I come now to aid conditionality, the thinking has been evolving a great deal in the World Bank and in the donor community. Indeed, the term conditionality is not very much used now. The results of various exercises that have been carried out to monitor the effectiveness of aid over the last few years have pointed to some clear conclusions, and you may be aware of a number of them, and these are largely that aid is most effective when it supports a strategy or a program that is developed by the government itself. Donors can come in to provide technical assistance, but indeed the program must be largely the government's itself. Now, in the case of Georgia, which had a strongly reformist program, and when I say reformist, I'm really talking of economic reforms and structural reforms towards developing a market economy for a post-Soviet transitional country, which is where the mandate of the World Bank lies, Georgia had a powerful reform momentum already going. That certainly helped donors in structuring their programs and in providing this extremely large amount of donor support, $4.5 billion, including support for the banking system, that was raised in the donor conference itself. There were perhaps one or two elements of the of aid conditionality that might be of interest. The first was a strong interest on the part of donors to protect social spending. I would say in discussions with the Georgian government, it quickly became apparent that one of the fundamentals for donor engagement would be a reorientation of public spending from defense, and defense spending had increased pretty rapidly for a period of about 3 to 5 years until the August 2008 conflict, towards social spending, and particularly spending that had an impact on poverty alleviation or minimization of new poverty cases, given the strong fall in economic growth, economic activity that was taking place, which was, of course, worsened by the international financial crisis. And hence, the effort of the World Bank was to provide resources to carry out this counter-cyclical fiscal policy that the government embarked on, to carry out the increased expenditures for investment, not only human investment in education and in health, but also in the infrastructure sectors. The Georgian government had always taken a philosophy of a small government and had sought to cap public expenditures to a ceiling of about 25% of GDP. But these ceilings were temporarily raised, and now we find that that in fact public expenditure next year is perhaps going to rise to as high as 35 plus, perhaps even close to 40% of GDP, before retreating again. Some of you may have been informed that the Georgian government has announced a constitutional amendment, which is the Constitutional Law on Liberty, Opportunity, and Dignity, as it is called, which would place a constitutional ceiling on budgetary expenditures at 30% of GDP, also have fairly strict caps on public debt. It would prohibit public ownership of banks, price controls, and so on, pretty far-reaching measures. No tax increases could take place without a referendum. These are measures that few countries have adopted, but they reflect the philosophy that the government had before the conflict, and it also reflects an attempt to return to those once this temporary counter-cyclical policy comes to an end. As a result of the understanding with donors, in fact, we have seen this year a considerable increase in spending in social protection. by almost 15 to 20%, in health and in education by similar amounts, as well as in transport, whereas there has been a massive decrease in defense expenditures. Defense expenditures before the conflict were about 1.2 billion lari a year, and now they are below half a billion lari a year. My final point on aid conditionality relates to the programs that the World Bank is running in Georgia itself, which is support for what we call development policy operations. And here you can see that, and these documents are public, and I can make them available. They are on our website. Here you can see that the main thrust of the policy reforms that are being supported lie in improving the efficiency and effectiveness of public finances by developing results-oriented budgets, for example, multi-year public investment programs, as well as on improving the effectiveness of the social safety net. This is improved targeting of the TSA, the Targeted Assistance Program, as well as increasing the number of beneficiaries, improvements in access to healthcare, and various and a whole set of measures to improve external competitiveness of the economy, including tax reforms in taxes and customs. Finally, a comment on the transparency of the JNA process. As I've tried to explain, over the years, through agreements with other donors and particularly the United Nations, we have developed not only this common methodology that I've been talking about, but also a set of understandings on how to involve civic society, both in the country concerned itself, as well as international civic society, international NGOs, and so on. And there has been a great effort towards improving transparency throughout the process, so that from the beginning to the end, not only are a lot of documents released, but also documents are released in such a form that they are put up for consultation, so that feedbacks from society in general can be integrated into the process of developing the JNA itself. And all of this has been codified in a number of declarations that donors now try to follow. The JNA was developed with consultation with civic society in the way we have described, but at the request of the Georgian government, the document itself was not disclosed at the time of the donor conference, or at least the full document was not disclosed, but a part of the document, which contained all the essential analysis and the entire financing table that put forward the estimates for donor assistance according to the different categories, all that was disclosed. The main reason why the entire document was not disclosed was concern by the Georgian government that the information on the banking system in the document was particularly sensitive, and that had it been disclosed, it might have created a great deal of concern, which would have fed back in a form of a vicious circle into reduced confidence in the banking system itself, further withdrawal of deposits from the banking system, greater reluctance by international private banks to support the Georgian banking system itself. I think it is right to say, on a matter of record, that the donors, all the donors, advised strongly against this. But given this judgment that the Georgian government had reached itself, we decided to respect that judgment and not release the document in its complete form. But the form that was released actually amounts to what I have described, everything really except the banking system. Now, since then, there have been some important changes. The first progress report of the JNA that we produced in July has been fully disclosed, and that contains a wealth of information about where the aid is coming from, how it is being used, and what are the plans for the future. And this is being supplemented by the information on the Ministry of Finance websites as well. During the course of this year, there have been greater and greater outreach efforts by the Ministry of Finance, such that regular meetings take place not only with donors themselves, which was always the case, but also with civic society, institutions, and Parliament is being informed in a more complete and a more timely framework than before. But of course, there is room for improvement, and I think the donor should be in continuous dialogue with the Georgian authorities themselves, as well as civic society in general and institutions such as this one, to make sure that the process continues to improve. Thank you.
I think we're going to give the floor right now to Timuna Karasimidze.
Very much. I will also start out by thanking Open Society Institute for this for organizing the panel discussion, and also to Open Society Georgia Foundation for funding our monitoring efforts, as well as the monitoring efforts of the NGO coalition that was mentioned here. I would like to break my presentation into four major sections. In the first one, I'm going to give you some more information about the aid pledged, the post-GNA process. In the second part, I would like to talk about the positive developments to date. Then I will speak about the problems and concerns to date, and I will finalize with giving some recommendations to the Georgian government, to donors. In terms of pledged funding, as was mentioned here, the Georgian government requested $3.5 billion USD. And in the donors' conference, the donors actually pledged to assist Georgia with $4.55 billion USD, which was a very important pledge, obviously. There were 38 countries and 15 institutions that pledged this assistance, and 95% of assistance was actually pledged by 15 donors. Most of them were country donors, and others were, six of them were financial institutions and also European Union. U.S., as you might know, was the biggest donor. U.S. pledged $1 billion USD, and in the PowerPoint presentations that is at the table behind you, you can see the breakdown of the U.S. Pledged funding, and I'm not going to go through that. The biggest financial institution donor was EBRD, which pledged $927 million. And as was mentioned here, main funding priorities were initially direct budget support. Also, some money was pledged for assisting IDPs, for other type of social assistance, assisting socially vulnerable groups, non-IDPs. Also for infrastructural projects, mainly energy and roads, and also for municipal infrastructure. And there was funding allocated, very little amount, but still for agricultural development and for environmental protection. In 2008, out of this pledged funding, Georgia, about $975 million was actually committed. And out of this $975 million, about half was the direct budget support, $405 million USD. And more than half were grants, which was obviously a very important thing for the 2008. But in 2009, more funding was committed, over $1.8 billion USD. And out of that funding, though, a majority of funds, over two-thirds, were loans that were given by financial institutions. But in 2009, Georgia received a lot less direct budget support, about $140 million. All of these figures are in the PowerPoint presentation as well. Now I will move on to the second section of the presentation, which is positive developments. And I should again start out by highlighting that this $4.55 billion USD assistance was a very important assistance for Georgia in terms of political support that was shown by the countries after the war, as well as in terms of financial support for protecting Georgia's fiscal sector, and also for economic support. And as was mentioned here, Georgia's foreign direct investment dropped significantly after the war. Currently, it's about at the rate of 20% to what it was before the war. And Georgian economy was very heavily based on FDI, so it was very important for Georgia to get money from outside to maintain its economic activity, and also for the banking sector and construction sector, which were the two most developed sectors before the war, not to collapse. And also for the Georgian government to be able to pay salaries and pensions through the direct budget support that it got. What's also very important is that 53% of the pledged funding has already been committed. After the donors' conference, there were some concerns in Georgia that due to various reasons, including financial crisis, including the fact that maybe some parliaments, the legislative bodies, would not approve giving this money to Georgia, and also possibly due to poor performance of the Georgian government, donors would not actually commit the pledged funds. But as I mentioned, already 53% of the funds have been committed, which is also And as was mentioned here, there is a breakdown. There is a very transparent breakdown of which donors, either countries or financial institutions, are giving what amounts of money to Georgia for what purposes. And indeed, this breakdown is available on the Ministry of Finance's website, and this breakdown was made available very soon after the conflict. In that database, you can see, again, which donor is giving us how much money for over what time period and for what sector. And also currently the Ministry of Finance is working on putting together a more comprehensive database that is going to give us sectoral information. We will know which donors are giving how much money for IDP support. And also we're going to know not only how much money the Georgian government is getting after the donors conference, but also which donors are carrying out different projects independently from the government. So hopefully, once this database is available, and according to the Ministry of Finance, this database is going to be completed and publicized by the end of this year, we're going to have a lot more comprehensive information about the first financial assistance. And also, importantly enough, as the Ministry of Finance says currently, this database is going to be updated on an ongoing basis. I should also highlight that the cooperation of Georgian NGOs with the Ministry of Finance has definitely been very good, and we do have regular meetings with the Deputy Minister of Finance, who provides us information about the ongoing negotiations with donors and also gives us the updated lists of committed and dispersed funds. And also some other government institutions, and I should name the Municipal Development Fund, and this is the government agency that spends big part of this money for rehabilitation projects, is also trying to be transparent at the level of giving us information about what kind of projects they're carrying out and how much money they're spending on these projects. Another positive development is that NGOs and media are actually paying attention to donor assistance, and NGOs have formed a coalition. And in this coalition, you have NGOs from very different sectors, those that will look at local government sector, those that look at environmental issues, TI Georgia mainly focused with corruption, and we are now working together, and we have divided up functions to provide more comprehensive analysis of aid transparency agency. And finally, I should mention that through this aid, and after the war, Georgian government has actually started looking at the IDP problem in a more long-term perspective. If before the war, IDP assistance was mainly humanitarian type of assistance, and IDPs were getting like small monthly allowances, currently the Georgian government has developed an action plan that is more comprehensive and is trying to provide better housing to IDPs and to solve their problem in a kind of in a more long-term perspective. And this is a very important thing because IDPs, and I'm not talking only about new IDPs, but also about the old IDPs, and their number is about 225,000 from early 90s and late 80s. They had to suffer for a very long time, and they were in very difficult conditions under the previous government, and even with under the new government, there were cases of IDPs being evicted from their centers, their permanent temporary shelters. But now the situation has changed, and there is more attention on the IDPs. And I should again stress that this is a very complex issue, as the IDP population is about 7% of Georgia's current population at the moment. And from here, I'm going to have to move to the next section, which is problematic issues and the concerns to date. Some of the problems that, in TI Georgia's opinion, are very important and influence the aid process negatively. The first two problems that I would like to mention are not directly linked to aid, but these are the problems that existed in Georgia before the war and continue today and also negatively affect the aid process. The first one is the politics, complicated political situation in Georgia, what is making it difficult because of which media and is not paying enough attention to aid transparency and efficiency, and also this issue is not the central issue for general public and also for the opposition. When after the war, the Georgian president offered the opposition to take part in the so-called anti-crisis council, which would look at aid transparency, the opposition refused to be engaged in the anti-crisis council because they said that Georgia had a lot greater problems than transparency and efficiency of aid. And they wanted to talk about the constitutional reform, they wanted to talk about electoral reform and other bigger cross-sectoral issues, problematic issues that Georgia was facing then and it's still facing today. The second problem is, again, related to the first problem, it's the weak democratic institutions in Georgia. Parliament, which is therefore not able to carry out effective oversight of aid and not strong enough to ensure its transparency. Weak local government, which has also not been able to use this aid more effectively and become an important player of the aid process. Also media that is not independent and therefore is not paying enough attention and is not covering aid, the problematic issues related to aid and also related to IDPs and the kind of assistance. Before me, there was a talk about the GNA development, and I have to say that unfortunately, I would not agree that the GNA development was done through a participatory process. And one of the first criticisms of TI Georgia was that actually the GNA was developed in a very closed environment between the Georgian government and the donors. Several Georgian NGOs had a joint statement and several times called the donors and the government to open up the process and to engage Georgian NGOs in the process, but this never happened. At least I don't know of any NGOs that were involved in discussions around the GNA. And the argument that we heard back then from the government was that the document had to be developed in a very short period of time, and there was just no time for public discussion. But for the efficiency of the process, and most importantly for people to have confidence in this process, we thought it was very important for the NGOs, for civil society to be involved. And I would call your attention to the fact that TI Georgia carried out a public opinion poll, and one of the questions that we asked people was whether or not they trusted the government in identifying right priorities for donor spending, and only 10% of people who were polled said that they trusted the government to come up with right spending priorities. And with this, in this environment, it is very important to make sure that the decision making about how money should be spent be better. Also, from that on, these decisions have been made, and currently the Ministry of Finance continues negotiations with donors on new funding. And as I said, the outcomes of these negotiations are very transparent. We do get information from the Ministry of Finance who's giving us how much money, but the process of negotiation and how the donors and the government reach agreements on what to spend, what to provide funding for in future, it's still not very transparent. And not just Georgian NGOs, but most importantly Georgian public do not have a clear understanding of why the government or the donors are choosing these priorities and how this is happening. Another problematic issue that I would like to mention is speedy process. Very often the Georgian government uses this argument that we have to address, you know, that we have to use the window of opportunities. Donors are giving us money now and we should try to spend this money as soon as possible. And because of the speedy process, sometimes you have problems of very bad planning and good ideas are compromised by not so good implementation. That is very true, for example, for IDPs. IDP action plan was developed after some funding was already spent. Also, the big part of the IDP assistance action plan is to rehabilitate their collective centers. Standards for rehabilitation were developed just now when the rehabilitation process for the old collective centers is almost completed. Also, the privatization of the collective centers started before there was a good information campaign to explain to IDPs how this privatization was supposed to work. And currently you have IDPs who said that they did not understand the privatization process well. They signed the agreements just to make sure that they were not losing everything. Apparently they're not happy with the privatization. And you have other problems specifically related to IDP, and this is the sector that we monitored, and I don't want to generalize it over other sectors, but there are problems that just because the government wants to act quickly, sometimes it's better planning and detailed planning. Another thing is one of the commitments that donors made when they signed the Paris Declaration, when they signed the ACRA, when they joined the ACRA agreement, was that the assistance would be tied to capacity building. capacity building of the government institutions involved in spending money and capacity building monitor spending. Unfortunately, there are very few NGOs that have done assessment of government agencies who are involved in aid distribution and implementation. And also, there is not enough funding for NGOs to be able to better monitor these aids. In result, we have the situation when, as I said, there is a big transparency of donor assistance breakdown, but there is not enough transparency or there is not enough information about the quality of aid implementation or the quality of service delivery by the government. Most of the donors themselves are focused on financial auditing, and they do hire some of the most reputable audit firms to carry out financial auditing of the government spending of their money, but they do not pay enough attention to performance auditing. Georgia's government institutions, oversight institutions, are not also very strong and are not qualified enough to carry out efficient performance auditing. So this is one area, an important area of the aid process, where there is not enough capacity and therefore there is not enough of performance auditing. How effective this aid process has been to date, and what kind of part of this problem also is that Georgian NGOs are also not experienced in carrying out performance. In our coalition, as well as in the efforts of other NGOs, you will see that we are doing pretty much similar activities, and we are doing what we know how to do. We're monitoring procurement processes, we're looking at the IDP assistance and how that works, we're trying to increase transparency of the government, but because we have no experience in assessing construction works, infrastructural works, also carrying out generally performance auditing, we do either very little or almost no performance auditing, and therefore we're also not being able to help to reduce that gap. And one, connected to NGOs, that will be, I mentioned briefly already, but would like to expand, speak a bit more about this issue. It's very little funding to for NGOs to monitor the aid process. I mentioned the NGO coalition, and I should mention that so far the Soros is the only foundation that is providing direct assistance to monitor aid process. Other donors have not been so actively involved in supporting NGOs to promote their to improve their capacity, or for them to monitor different parts of the aid process, and therefore there is not enough NGO monitoring of 4.55 billion USD pledged, and 53% of it already been. The last big problem that I should mention is communication with general public, not just with NGOs, not just the coordination between donors and the government, but communication with general public, and also making sure that this communication is two-way, that people exactly how this aid process is being implemented, what are the results to date, and also for them to have some mechanisms to give information, feedback to the government about what are their thoughts about this. This is especially important for IDPs. And unfortunately, currently, there are no formal mechanisms for IDPs to provide their feedback about the IDP action plan and about its implementation. But there are also no feedback mechanisms in other sectors. And most importantly, I mentioned that there is a good coordination with the Ministry of Finance. Some of the government agencies are trying to be transparent, but this process, again, is not institutionalized. And currently, it's very much dependent on the kind will of, namely the Deputy Minister of Finance, who very actively meets with us and gives us information, but it is, again, not an institutionalized process, and very heavily hanging on that one man in the Ministry of Finance. And in the recommendations, obviously, are based on the problems and come from the problems. And some of the recommendations, very briefly, that I would like to mention is it's very important for the donors to set political conditions, and that is one thing that I did not mention in my problems. Unfortunately, there were no political conditionalities attached to this aid. European Commission was the only donor, despite of the suggestions and requests of Georgian NGOs to have some political conditions attached to aid. European Commission was the only one that had political conditions, and the European Commission's conditions were very general. There were 5 points that were very general, such as independence of judicial. No other donors had such political conditionalities. And one of the arguments from the government person was that if donors have such political conditionalities, for example, such as independence of judiciary, then we might never be able to get this money. Another problem in Georgia, the problem is judicial independence. But still, there are some quick things that the government, some crucial and short-term things that the government could have implemented if there was more pressure from the donors. And also the donors could, together with the NGOs, develop some benchmarks on how to assess Georgian government's commitment to strengthening democracy and use another one would be transparency of, again, decision-making process. And again, the negotiations between the government and donors are still underway, and the donors and the government should try to increase transparency of this process and to explain to Georgian what their decisions are based on and how these decisions are helping Georgian public. It's important to have better planning and communication, not to use time constraints, not just as reason, but often as an excuse not to have better planning and not to have more participatory and open process. Reform design, more emphasis on quality assessment. Donors should request the government to provide some reports, comprehensive reports about the impact of aid, and also they should assist Georgian NGOs to learn how to carry out performance auditing. Institutionalization of transparency and accountability of governments and and then the final one would be better transparency from donor side. And I would again mention Paris Declaration and Accra Agreement. And I should say that there have been cases when we were not able to get some information from donors about the aid that were able to get that information from the Ministry of Finance.
A commitment. In fact, she's come all the way from Georgia to speak to us, so we're also happy to give you plenty of time to put out your thoughts that you've accumulated over the past year of monitoring the process. Now, before opening up the floor, I wanted to ask Soumya, you know, you were a lot of the points about transparency that you were making kind of refer back without actually mentioning the Paris Declaration on aid effectiveness, and we also have Tamuna referring to the Accra Agenda for Action, which both of which are kind of the international frameworks of best practice for these type of processes. Listening to Tamuna, I got the sense that even though probably all of the parties who participated as donors in the JNA and in pledging contributing funds for Georgia were signatories of the Paris Declaration. I got the sense listening to Tamuna that she was less than satisfied that they were kind of living up to their kind of commitments under the Paris Declaration. I wonder whether you picked that up in her remarks as well, and if so, what your thinking is.
I have a lot of sympathy with Tamuna's comments on this, and I'm glad she's not satisfied. And I think there should be a lot of people who are Georgian citizens not satisfied putting pressure on their government. That's entirely to be desired. I would say simply this, since the donor conference took place, and particularly in the course of this year, I think quite big changes in terms of transparency, actions that are taking place between the Ministry of Finance. I would not go so far as to to say, or as you implied, this might have been just one man, the Deputy Minister of Finance, Dimitri Adze, who's very active and good. But I think it is getting more institutionalized because the ministry itself has received a great deal and software and methods whereby all of these aid flows and can be properly registered and tracked, and the information go out, and for this to be related to results and to impact. But regardless of what happened at the time the JNA was written and the decisions the government took at that time, I think going forward we are finding more information being released and being used in an active way. And I would also say that it would be important to develop the feedback mechanisms, such as the ones from the IDPs that you were talking about, but also feedback mechanisms more generally throughout society, where education and health programs are being ramped up quite rapidly and being changed and reformed, so that that information feeds in as well.
Thank you. I mean, all of this transparency work, I mean, it's extremely important, and we're very committed to this. But I didn't catch in any comments or observations that you made that I guess the kind of the question hanging over a discussion of this sort is that the donor funds might somehow have been diverted or misused or kind of pocketed by someone, or that there was in the procurement process for various of these important infrastructure, major infrastructure projects, that funds were somehow improperly used. So do you believe that either the government has conducted itself in a transparent and honest fashion, and that all is well? And do you believe that this is the process? It was the government, in effect, aware that it was going to be so well monitored in this reconstruction process that no one has kind of dared to try anything untoward? Or is it that there's kind of imperfect knowledge, and there's been so much secrecy, as you have been concerned about, that we just don't know? So have funds been misused, or is the story that actually there was no misuse of funds, and all of this this work produced that result?
Hard for me to say that there either has been misuse of funds or that has not been misuse of funds. Again, I'm afraid that Georgian NGOs have not conducted monitoring that would be comprehensive enough. Georgia has been mainly focused on the IDP, assistance provided to IDP, and in that sector, I can say that the major problem has been lack of planning and not necessarily misuse of funds. However, lack of planning then leads to not sufficient spending, insufficiency. I should mention, though, that with procurement, that there have been some NGOs that have looked at procurement procedures. And for example, there are cases when procurement is, instead of public tenders, sole source procurement is used, and without clear justification of why government institutions decided to use sole source procurement as opposed to public tendering. So there have been cases in the case of municipal development fund that the procurement agreements are amended after the agreements are signed, and then the price of procurement are increased when the workload
audience has been taking this in and been very patient. Now it's your turn to ask questions. Because the event is being recorded, I need to ask those people who would like to pose a question to go to the mic and to speak into the mic. And before you pose your question, just state your name and affiliation. Uh, if there are no, okay, there is a some, there's some hands. Okay. Let's just make sure that the, is the mic on? Yeah.
Is, as I understand it from the, from particularly from your presentation, this is a combination of grants and loans and direct budgetary assistance, this money. How does Georgia have a strategy for repaying that, particularly given that they seem to have sworn off raising taxes again ever unless they get a majority in a referendum? So that's the first question. The second question is a more political question and just kind of it's a subjective question. There's no answer to it. But on this side of the ocean, when the assistance package is discussed, particularly European money, there is some question as to the motivation. And I'm curious, from your view and also, Tamuna, from your view on the ground, what do you think the motivation is? Some would say the motivation, and some do say, look, the war was devastating. There was a real feeling that Georgia was the victim of Russian aggression, and there was a sense we want to help Georgia. Then there's a sense of maybe it's just hush money, right? Maybe it's here's some money. We need to be left alone for a while. And you hear both those things. You hear both those things in Washington. You hear both those things in Brussels. I'd be interested in your thoughts on both those questions.
Tamuna, you want to go first?
On the Georgia's ability to repay it, I can only give you the information that we have from the Ministry of Finance. Most of the loans that Georgia is receiving are the so-called concessional loans. The interest rates on them is not more than 1%. There is one case when it's over 1.5%. And there, the long grace period in Georgia does not have to repay these debts in over, in some cases, for next 40 years. So before the war, Georgia's debt was 15% of GDP. And according to the Ministry of Finance, it's not going to go even in the worst period, which is over the worst period. It's not going to go over 30%. And then they compare this number to the to Georgia's debt under Shevardnadze's time, which was 50% of GDP. But this is all the information that I have from the Minister of Finance, and this is all. As for the second question, this is my subjective opinion. My feeling is that this money that Georgia, well, one thing I should say is that big part of the loans that Georgia is receiving were the loans that were committed before the war. These were the loans about which Georgia already had discussions with financial institutions, and in the big part, this was already pre-agreed between the Georgian government and financial institutions, and also with some countries, with Japan, for example. The Japanese government and JICA was already interested in providing assistance to Georgia, and they were already in the preparation of the Japanese embassy. In case of the United States and some other donors, in my opinion, it was largely political support. And with European countries as well, Europe was not able to introduce very strict sanctions against Russia after the war, and then it decided to assist Georgia with finances just to show its political support to the country.
Well, I think Tamuna's answered the question on the debt burden very well. Both the IMF and the World Bank, of course, pay a great deal of attention to the debt country's ability to carry that debt burden, and for factors she mentioned, I think operations have been quite prudent. You have to bear in mind, though, one thing, which is that 3 years ago, Georgia issued a bond in the international markets for about $500 million, which is on commercial rates. This falls due in another 3 to 4 years, and that causes a large hump in payments. So apart from dealing with that particular bunching of maturities, there is which will be dealt with only by taking on some fresh credit and by rolling it forward and so on, so smoothing it, there will remain also the need to service IMF credits, which are on much shorter maturities indeed. So what this means is that although the debt burden is prudent, it still requires a great deal of management and agility for all debt operations to go through smoothly in the future. On the motivation, well, my institution is, to give it its full name, is the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development. And as you know, it started its life as a reconstruction bank after the Second World War, where the first loans were made to the Netherlands and to France for reconstruction. we approach it in the same spirit. This has been a conflict-affected country, unfortunately one of many. Of our work, which is to restore economies, infrastructure, societies, deal with refugees and the internally displaced, and it is on that that we rest the work we have done.
Yeah, just I have a figure here, Lincoln, that the Eurobond that was taken out, as Samuel points out, before the war, is going in 2013 is going to constitute 14%. Of government revenue in 2013. So that means that in 3 years, a huge chunk, unless it's kind of smoothed, is they're going to face a huge payment problem. But that's not going to owe from all of this concession. It predates this, and in fact, both the aid and the debt are all kind of pre-existing. It seems that from the analysis that has been published in a quite good paper put out by the Open Society Georgia Foundation by George Welton, all of the aid that was pledged was just the effect of the war was to move it up. There was a lot of aid being discussed, and the war, in effect, ensured that it was paid out, and it was paid very, very quickly, rather than being kind of attenuated. So
there was a lot of new aid as well. There was a great deal of new aid, particularly all the bilateral aid that you see. For example, the largest aid providers, United States, Japan, the European Union. A great deal of that money is entirely new and is. But yeah. The important point is that it is all either grant or on such soft terms as to have a very large grant element, and therefore its debt creating impact is limited.
63%, according to what I've been reading here, 63% is loans. So it's actually. The Georgian people are going to be paying back two-thirds of that.
Right. But loans, for example, the World Bank operations are under the concessional window, and the interest rate for that is 0.5% a year. Mm. So it's pretty. And the maturities are 30 or 40 years. I forget which. It's either 30 or 40, 0.5% interest, and 10 years grace. So it's.
Hi, my name is George Ingelay. I'm from Georgian Daily and Global Middle Market Market Capital Opportunity Fund. I'm Georgian American, and this is a really painful subject to me. When Georgia went after such a terrible war, it is terrible. Although for the world arena, it's not that of big importance. My question is regarding media independence in Georgia. I know, first of all, the meaning of independence I did not quite understand. Is this independent from the government or some other entity? And another thing is that I'm a frequent visitor to Georgia, and I see that about 95% of newspapers is oppositional media. And there are oppositional TV channels as well. So if meaning of independence means that there is no oppositional coverage, that's also important. And does it mean that the coverage of fund disbursement is not covered well enough with the media that exists there? Thank you.
When we talk about media, we do have to divide electronic media, mainly TV, and print media. I agree that with print media, there is no control from the government, and most of the newspapers are definitely opposition and write very critical articles about the government. But according to the public opinion poll, readership of newspapers is very low, so newspapers do not really influence public opinion. Over 70% of Georgians get their information from TV stations, and mainly from national TV stations. And when I mentioned that there is no there's a problem with independence of media in Georgia. I mainly talk about the national TV stations that are not controlled from the government. We do not have any national TV stations right now that are free from the government control through different means, either by direct ownership of the government and or by the fact that the national TV stations that are commercial are owned by people who are very close to the government. And if government wanted to address that problem, there are a few things that it could do. One is to promote transparency of media ownership. With the main national TV stations in Georgia, we still do not know who their official owners are. This information must be public according to Georgia's legislation, but it's not public information. Also, there have been some very, suspicious processes of transfer of ownership of national TV stations. Most of the former owners of TV stations claim that they were forced by the government to give the ownership of TV station to another person, which at that moment would be somebody close to the government. The government is not investigating these issues. And also, on national TV stations, we still do not have any investigative journalism. There are three independent groups of journalists currently in Georgia who produce investigative documentaries, but none of national TV stations are willing to show them. And under Shevardnadze's government, we had the program called 60 Minutes, which was very similar to American 60 Minutes. And that program showed investigative documentaries every week. And that program was very popular among Georgian public, one of the most watched programs. And it should be in the interest of commercial TV stations to air investigative documentaries that people like to watch. But unfortunately, on national TV stations, we do not have any of that. Even though public broadcasting, the media TV station that is getting paid money from state budget, is paying journalists, the so-called investigative journalists, salaries, they still have not produced anything that has been aired by and the leadership of the public broadcast says that these people are being trained. And the fact also is that on national TV stations, you do not see problems of IDPs discussed. Very rarely will you see that. Most of the time you see different government officials going to collective centers, giving some humanitarian assistance to IDPs. That's when IDP issue is brought up on national TV stations. Otherwise, there's very little coverage of what kind of problems these people are
experiencing. Go ahead.
Sandy Colliver with the Open Society Justice Initiative. I was intrigued by your mention of the importance of the independence of the judiciary, and I suppose that that means that the courts aren't very, of course. I'm wondering, I know that the Georgia Young Lawyers Association has been taking cases to court in order to get access to certain documents, and that they've had some successes and some failures. I wonder if you're familiar with their work and if you think that taking these cases to court does have the capacity of promoting the openness and building some precedents.
We are aware of Young Lawyers' work, and we work very closely with them. They have had some successes with judiciary, but not so many. And when I speak about independence of judiciary, I will again use public opinion poll. And Transparency International, the international office, conducts every year the so-called Global Corruption Barometer, the opinion survey, when Georgian citizens and citizens of different countries are asked about what they think of different state institutions in their country. And since 2006, judiciary in Georgia has been topping the list as the least trusted state institution. With judiciary, I must say that since the Rose Revolution, the Georgian government has taken some measures, some very important measures to increase effectiveness of judiciary. One positive development I should mention is that currently there's a lot less bribery in judiciary because of very high salaries that judges get and because of prosecution of bribery and corruption. Also, the infrastructure has been developed. The president no longer appoints judges, and there have been other positive developments in terms of amending legislation. But still, judiciary is believed to be controlled by the executive and mainly by the prosecutor's office. And this year, the Georgian parliament adopted the law on expat communication on the on judges. And according to the law, if anybody tries to influence judges' decisions, that person must be sanctioned. And the president, in his last speech during the Biden's visit, said that the sanctions should be made stricter. And instead of administrative sanctions, which But no matter how strict sanctions are, the law can hardly work, because by this law, if the judiciary, if judge is influenced by someone, he or she must report to prosecutor's office. And in Georgia, when pressure mainly comes from prosecutor's office, it's unlikely for judges to report to prosecutor's office. And the fact is that since the adoption of this law, there were seven cases of somebody being sanctioned, and in majority of for trying to influence the judge's decision, and in majority of cases, these were defenders and never a prosecutor. And with judiciary, it really is the matter where you need political will from the government to increase its independence. The way to assess whether or not judiciary is independent is to look at high-profile cases. So far, with the high-profile cases, you can see the heavy hand of government. One of the latest ones is this so-called mutiny and suspicious environment. Suspicions.
Thank you so much for the interesting information. My name is Cassie Suzuki. I used to do energy research at JETRO and the part of the department of the METI, the energy department of the Japan. I think the country I came from, we don't have much resources like oils and coals and things. So which motivated the government. I don't think they really expect the loan to be paid or anything. But in future, I mean, maybe it's stupid to say that, but I know that, you know, they invest in developing country, waiting like years for them to have their own industries, export, import, and resources. What I'm thinking is, originally, these projects the Georgian government mentioned motivated the donors put billion of dollars to the country. What I think is, do you think Georgian government kind of show what's happening with these projects, what kind of development, what can be done with it, especially after the war? I mean, for instance, you ask donation, and then nothing will happen. Or you don't know what's happening with the project you really donated, that really pushed down, you know, your motivation to put more money into it. Do you think the government of Georgia show other nations that how much it was done, how much it would be done? Are they clear about time period, forecast? Do you have any opinion of this?
If I've understood, well, thank you for the question. If I've understood it correctly, I think what you were asking for is, what is the relationship or interaction between the government and the donors, and are they realistic in their expectations of each other? In the case of projects that you have mentioned, the post-conflict reconstruction phase is designed for a period of something like 3 to 4 years. And as we discussed initially, a lot of money has gone into budget support for current expenditures and supporting IDPs and so on. On that, we have pretty good information, because these are flows that go through the budget, and there's a great deal of information and auditing about budget flows. There is improving information about the effectiveness and the results that are being obtained, although there is considerable. When you talk about the projects themselves, and here perhaps you're referring to the infrastructure projects. Now, infrastructure projects by their nature take a period of some years of gestation. And we are at an initial phase now, for example, with the East-West Highway, which is a major construction activity in the transport sector. There are projects in energy to do with transmission lines, storage. And there are a number of municipal projects on urban water, sanitation, solid waste management, not just in Tbilisi, but also in many cities, Kutaisi, Gori, Zugdidi, Sena. All of these would be monitored carefully, and donors would be getting information on these, and flows would be adapted in the light of implementation of the program. So if the program goes fast, the flows come in faster, if they go slower, if projects need to be restructured and so on, these factors are taken into account. I think the donors have pretty realistic, even if they are high, expectations of Georgia, because its record of implementation of projects has been pretty impressive. And I think if I understood another comment you made correctly, I don't think there is at all the thinking in the Georgian government that these loans, soft loans, are not there to be paid back. Of course, grants don't have to be paid back, but these soft loans have a large maturity, and the full intention is to pay them back as they arise. And indeed, any responsible debtor would do that, particularly one that has quite a lot of debt in the form of a Eurobond, as well as borrowings from the IMF.
Did you want to say anything? Or?
No, I would just mention, once you talk about the Japanese government, that one of the things that TI Georgia looks at is transparency of donors. And I would like to inform you as a Japanese citizen that the Japanese government is actually one of the least transparent donors. We, again, try to get information from government and also to get information from donors and to compare this information. And for that, we need assistance from donors. And we did ranking of donors based on their transparency, and Japanese government was one of the least transparent.
Well, we talked earlier that you know, your words would go far. Actually, if you wanted to advise Barack Obama, he's across the street tonight. That's what all the barricades and police are about. The Obama administration has been a big proponent of, in the very first executive orders that they issued about transparent government and so on. I don't know how successful it's been so far in institutionalizing that, but institutionalizing the spirit of the Paris Declaration and the Accra Agenda, and the types of efforts which, from this evening's, at least from Tamuna's characterization of it, would seem to be somewhat of an ad hoc or personal nature. Institutionalization of this would seem to be an important priority before attention, as it does, wanders off to some other priority, some other emergency. So, Samia, you've been involved with these JNAs, obviously, in not just in Georgia, and I've seen them come and go, and seen these processes in a kind of comparative light. And I wonder whether you would have any thoughts about how one can think about institutionalizing the transparency, this kind of multi-stakeholder roundtable where you have the donor governments, the recipient government, civil society representing the public. You know, it's interesting, in all of this, we haven't really heard very much at all about, except for the Anti-Crisis Committee, about the role of Parliament in supervising these funds. So maybe think a little bit about your past experience and how we can institutionalize this. And Tamuna, also maybe, as we kind of move to concluding this evening, what your plans are, the coalition, for trying to secure some more meaningful long-term gains in terms of the institutionalization that we discussed, I guess, when we were in Tbilisi and that you talked about tonight. So, Samia, do you want to start, and then Tamuna?
All right. I think transparency is enormously important for donor operations in general, of which post-conflict and JNA is a part. Fortunately, a small part, and I hope it becomes a negligible part, because that means we won't have conflicts. But what donors have been trying to do, particularly the World Bank, but also important bilateral donors, the British DFID, is to build in transparency throughout the donor process and the aid process in normal projects. And we would like to see that in the JNA as well. Now, what often happens in the immediate heat of a conflict or post-conflict, governments are often enormously burdened. They are nervous about what has happened and you know, what's likely to follow. They don't know if the conflict will recur. So a great deal of attention. So the natural tendency is to hunker down a bit, you know, and to think of other priorities than simply spending a lot of time communicating with civic society and talking to other donors. I think is a natural reaction. But that is something we try to counter through the structures that have been built up, which are called Accra or Paris or whatever. And I think it's very, very important to continue to use them. And that is the form of institutionalization that is the most important. I think Tamuna was entirely right in talking about the role of parliament, opposition, and the judiciary. Now, these are areas we in the World Bank don't work on directly, but that doesn't mean we don't keep our ears open and we don't listen to others. Georgia's case, I do not think you can institutionalize transparency and a more regular way of doing business without greatly increasing the independence and the power of these institutions. The final comment I would make is this. We all want NGOs and others to play a bigger role, and that's fine. There are good reasons for that, so I don't need to go into. But let us not forget that the institution that is responsible to the Georgian people for using the money effectively is the government. That is the sole elected institution. It answers to parliament, and it can lose a vote of confidence in parliament. Now, this is not just mere law, but that is how it really ought to work. And so, in that sense, I think the accountability of government to parliament is the most important, in a sense. And of course, it must be open to NGOs, which after all have expertise but are not elected by anybody, and they are responsible to donors too, who help them. But this channel of responsibility to the people through parliament, in my view, is the most important, and that is where institutionalization really needs to take place.
First goal, obviously, is I talked a lot about how the NGOs have not done enough for performance analysis, and the coalition plans to pay more attention to this issue, not just push for transparency, but also improve our capacity and also to do more of performance auditing and to fill that gap. As for how to institutionalize the process of coordination and accountability, one of the things we want to do is to do the analysis of strengths and weaknesses of different government institutions and to provide recommendations to donors on how to increase capacity of this government, their weak points, as well as to provide some constructive recommendations to government about how they can benefit from addressing these weaknesses. And another thing that we need to do is to increase local demand for aid transparency. And I think there is still not enough public attention to this issue, not enough media attention, even from opposition TV stations. And we NGOs need to do some more this demand to put pressure on the government to institutionalize the process.
We're efficient. I was working to a 90-minute schedule, and then I just looked at the papers, and we actually have another. We have the room for another 30 minutes. So, so if we haven't exhausted your curiosity or your interest, we can take more questions. Great. We have two more questions.
George Wilton. I'm an independent researcher in Georgia, actually. And I wrote the
nice paper
that you've been referring to about the IFI. Well, actually, more accurately, it's not about the IFI, but about the loan component of the the thing. And a small correction in relation to that, the 14% actually refers to what the total debt burden will be as a proportion of receipts, rather than specifically what the 500 million of Eurobond would amount to, although the Eurobond does end up being a lot of that. I wouldn't want the Eurobond to be blamed for all of Georgia's debts. I just wanted to make one point and partly kind of pose it as a question to the gentleman from the World Bank, which is that I also wrote a paper for International Budget Partnership on financial transparency in Georgia. And I think while it's an absolutely laudable ambition to say that the government is the only democratically elected institution and ultimately its oversight needs to take place through parliament, and that is where we ought to be focusing our attention, in a government situation or in an elected situation where you have a parliament that has more than a two-thirds majority, so that it can, for example, make changes to budgetary it can make changes to the constitution, such as those we've just seen suggested here, which may be great, great things to aim for as budgetary ambitions, but whether they're sensible things to incorporate into your constitution, I think, is another matter. Putting that to one side, when you find yourself in a situation where there is just such a vasted, there is such a very strong power in, of the same party in both parliament and government, it seems that the parliament is not necessarily in the short term the institution to which you expect to look for oversight of the government. It seems like there's been a little bit of a missed opportunity with this aid money. And I don't think, and it's not conditionality of the where exactly they spend money side. It is actually specifically in relation to one institution, which is the Public Audit Office. And the Public Audit Office is the one institution that the World Bank has straightforwardly said has failed to achieve the objective that was set out in the PRSO. It's the one institution which has led the EU to actually withhold funds that had previously been were going to be released. And both of these things are, you know, don't happen very often. The World Bank doesn't straightforwardly and publicly criticize in that way. The EU doesn't straightforwardly withhold funds in that way. It seems like there was an opportunity, and my question is, do we think there still could be an opportunity to use some of this money as some kind of test case for public service delivery audits within the Public Audit Office? Because the Public Audit Office at the end of last year did pass a law which required that 2 or 3 years from now it is supposed to be in a position to do public service audits. It, however, has no real strategy for getting there. And it seems like it ought to be a reasonable condition that could be put on some of this money to say, well, we want to work with the Public Audit Office to make sure that they achieve certain kinds of benchmarks in order to be able to give us feedback on these kind of institutions, with parallel evaluations being done by different kinds of institutions at the same time. Before we're going to disperse X, Y, or Z 2 years from now.
Thank you.
So rather long, but thank you.
No, not long. Interesting. You had a number of put asides, which are also interesting to talk about, but I'll put them aside. On your main question, the World Bank, and I can't speak for the European Commission, but I do know that the European Commission also. Both these institutions have not lost their interest in engaging the government on reform of the public audit. That continues to be a significant element in our dialogue. There are a number of reasons why I wouldn't go down the path of saying, if you don't do this, you won't get this aid. It's quite in keeping with our very cooperative relationship with the Georgian government, and I think. The government itself is convinced of reforms in this area. It has found the going tough for a number of reasons. I think you know that it's highly political. It involves the parliament as well. It involves different institutions in Georgia, not the government itself. An earlier version of the law had a serious problem in that the public audit institution's authority was to extend over the central bank, which had implications for the independence of the central bank, and that became a big political issue and itself caused months, if not a year, of delay. And that was of great concern to us as well as to the IMF as well. But both the bank and the EC, I think, remain determined to help the country get that reform right. The conflict, again, delayed it by several months. So we think that the coming months and years is going to be very important for that. As a part of the overall, let's put it this way, the better climate for judicial reforms, or the progress that has been made, some of which was described on judicial reform, we think the conditions for moving forward on the public audit reform too.
To that point, I would just add that, in general, the oversight is a big problem in Georgia. The Chamber of Control, the public audit institution in Georgia, is not politically independent and also is not qualified enough to carry out a quality assessment. Currently, the Chamber of Control is again going through reorganization, and they say that in the next year, 2 years, they're not going to be able to do any performance auditing, even though this is a part of their law. And I should mention that the Chamber of Control has been getting funding from donors to improve its capacity for years now. It's not just 1 year ago or 2 years ago, but UNDP and some other donors, GTZ, have been investing in the Chamber of Control for a long time. And unless there are some benchmarks, there are some conditionalities from donors to really increase effectiveness of the Chamber of Control and to make it independent, then just assistance, financial assistance, just training of auditors is not going to be enough to make this institution strong. And the same is true for other oversight institutions. Statistics department, donors will have to very heavily rely on statistics department to assess impact of their aid. And statistics department currently is not politically independent enough and is not qualified enough to provide good independent data. The same is true for parliament, and the parliament was already discussed here, so I will not go into details. This parliament, with the constitution, the ruling party having constitutional majority, is simply not able to carry out effective oversight over the executive, and it has not done it so far. And the public procurement agency, which is supposed to oversee procurement processes, also lacks political independence, lacks qualification to carry out effective.
Published by OSGF, which I'm not sure whether it's methodologically correct, but it did a comparison of the pledges and then reflection of corresponding categories in the 2008 and 2009 state budgets of Georgia and points to a series of discrepancies between money that was either disbursed through loans or grants to the government of Georgia for certain items, and then looked in the state budget to see whether the same amount of money was being allocated through that process. Again, I don't know whether methodologically the budget is the proper tool. Maybe Dr. Welton has knowledge of that, or you have some opinion, but it also put the reconciliation of these discrepancies as one of the tasks before the Chamber of Control, the Supreme Audit Institution. Not sure whether the budget is the place to look for a kind of a one-to-one matching of these donor commitments, but this paper also kind of points to that task before the chamber, which seems to be a challenged body to carry it out. Sir, you had another question? Please.
Yes, it seems to me that there is a lack of human resources in NGOs, because I observed that during last several years, most of leaders of NGOs went to the government, and there was some sort of vacuum created in that aspect. And it's probably lack of human resources. And do you think that it is only related to funds for NGOs, or also experience of people? Thank you.
I agree with you that there is lack of human resources, and I think that the reasons are both. NGOs were very strong under Trevor Nadas' government, and one of the reasons to that was that donors provided a lot more money than to the government, nearly, for NGOs to monitor and basically to, in some cases, replace the government in terms of service delivery. So that is one reason. After the Rose Revolution, funding for NGOs unfortunately dropped significantly, and that still continues. And I can mention that in $1 billion USD that was pledged by the U.S. government, there's very little part of that money that is going to go into strengthening democracy and into providing assistance to NGOs to monitor government's activities. And the second reason is that it's not just that some NGO leaders have moved to the government. Some of them actually have moved to the opposition as well. The thing is that I think that the job of the older NGOs was a bit easier, because that government, everybody agreed that Shevardnadze's government was bad. There was not much disagreement about it, either within the country and also from the international community side, although the international community was not so public about it until the very last moment. In the with the current government, they have the mixed situation. It's not just bad. If you actually divide the reforms that the government has carried out, if you look at the reforms that the government has carried out, it has carried out some very significant reforms. But all of these reforms are in the sectors that are not politically sensitive. And I can mention very many very successful reforms carried out by the government. But when it comes to democratic institutions and building democratic institutions, I can name very few sectors, if I can name any, where there has been strengthening and where the government has put enough efforts into building democratic institutions. And unfortunately, the international community has been paying a lot more attention to some of the successful reforms in non-political, sensitive sectors, and then has kind of blind-eyed its own democratic institutions and government actually not building, not strengthening democratic institutions, but making some of them weaker, one of them being. I think the problem is that the international community at times wanted to use Georgia as a success story. And when Georgian NGOs were criticizing the government for trumping democratic institutions, international community rather highlighted some of the positive developments and said that, yes,
I would just say that in visiting Tbilisi last week and kind of following these transparency efforts, you know, one could very humbly talk about the needs for greater capacity. But I've personally been very impressed by the dedication and the intelligence and indeed how articulate and purposeful some of the civil society organizations have been. And that's why I think that, you know, we ought to particularly focus on trying to how to institutionalize and build capacity at the same time, so that these groups have the continued opportunity to follow up on this. But I think that, you know, one of the unexpected outcomes of this donor process has been this kind of a flurry of fiscal transparency and accountability work around this, and that is in some way one of the great outcomes of what is otherwise a kind of very tragic situation that evolved after the war last summer. If we don't have any more questions, I think that this is perhaps a good place to stop thinking about the articulate, purposeful, and inspiring work of groups like Timuna's Transparency International Georgia. I also want to thank Samia Mitra for contributing. I think we've had an unusually meaty, substantive conversation this evening, and thanks to both of our speakers for leading us in that.